We are thrilled to be joined today by the 51st Attorney General of the great state of Ohio. That is Dave Yost. Dave Yost has been the Attorney General of Ohio since January 2019. So General Yost, we really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
I thought for our conversation today, we would start at the national level and then take it a little more local back to Ohio. So one national issue that you have been very much vocal and in the news about recently, you had a Wall Street Journal op-ed to this effect just a few weeks ago now, was this upcoming case of the U.S. Supreme Court on April 25th pertaining to the breadth and depth of presidential immunity for criminal prosecution once a president leaves office. This is, of course, in the context of Donald Trump and special counsel Jack Smith's federal probe there in Washington, D.C. Why don't you just walk us through your argument? Your op-ed was adapted from an amicus brief that you filed at the court. What are you arguing that the court should do when it comes to this pressing question of presidential immunity?
So we're arguing that neither of the camps that are before the court are really getting it quite right. On the one hand, Jack Smith has basically asserted that presidential immunity should be limited to civil matters, and that the line of Nixon cases that held that the president couldn't be an effective executive if he was constantly worrying about post-office civil liability simply don't apply to criminal matters. I think that's clearly wrong, because if the whole idea is I'm not going to be able to adequately guard the country, adequately enforce the laws, if I'm constantly thinking about whether I'll be deposed or sued and maybe lose money after I leave the presidency, and am therefore kind of paralyzed into inaction, that applies with even greater force and greater rigor when we're talking about the possibility of losing your liberty and going to prison. On the other hand, I don't think I can go quite so far as to say that immunity ought to be absolute, as was brought up in an earlier case. Does that mean that in the D.C. Circuit, I believe, does that mean that a president could order the assassination of a political rival and walk away scot-free? Well, clearly nobody would think that that was the thing. So what we propose is what we call a double nexus test. Essentially, how closely is this related to an actual Article II power? And secondly, how urgent are the circumstances that led to the taking of the action?
So that makes a lot of sense, this two-pronged test that you started to formulate there in the brief and in the Wall Street Journal op-ed. Can you just walk us through a little bit further here, this two-pronged test, nexus, and how close it is to a duty? Just walk us through a little bit how you anticipate this might reasonably apply, perhaps, to the case at hand.
Well, we did not argue the case at hand, and I'm going to decline to do that right now, because the reason I filed this brief is this is so important to the country and right. to an effective constitutional government that I think it's worth stepping outside the context of Donald Trump and Jack Smith. Everybody seems to have opinions on them. But to give you a little bit closer example, there are things that the president, clearly has to do. The conduct of foreign affairs, the direction of military operations, they're pretty much that's so closely tied
right.
To the core function of Article II. I don't even think one of these lawfare practitioners could figure out a way to say that a president was not immune. On the other hand, there's things that are more peripheral. An agency rulemaking might be an example, and the nexus to an enumerated power is weaker. That's not quite enough, though, because a core Article II power is appointments, right? That's right. What a president does is make appointments. And yet, that's not very often going to be urgent. Speed is not going to be of the essence. And so I think it's important to also to recognize that the urgency of the circumstances also helps strengthen, or the lack of urgency weaken, the protection that we would hope that a president would have for actions taken in office.
No, that's exactly right. And your argument makes a lot of sense to me. In fact, if I'm just putting on my prognosticator and commentator cap, I would anticipate that the ruling in late June, obviously, who the heck knows, but if I'm putting on my most reasonable guessing cap, I would probably anticipate that the outcome will be something along the lines of what you proposed here. There's an interesting part of the Wall Street Journal op-ed here, which again is adapted from Attorney General Dave Yost's amicus brief before the Supreme Court in the Trump presidential immunity case. And you say here that, interestingly, that Franklin D. Roosevelt, FDR, did not face prosecution for his order incarcerating Japanese Americans during World War II, even though those acts would be kidnapping and false imprisonment if undertaken by anyone else. The example that I've used when I just have in-person lay conversations with others about this is I typically say, you know, do Democrats really want to open up the can of worms whereby, let's say, for example, Barack Obama could be criminally prosecuted for homicide after his time as U.S. president for ordering the drone strike of then U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen back in 2011? So it's a really fascinating case for a lot of us constitutional law nerds. And I know, General Yost, I was very happy to see your contribution to this roiling debate. And we look forward to seeing how it is ultimately resolved. But moving on a little bit, and then just I want to zoom out here, and then we'll get into some of the weeds as to what's going on in the Buckeye State. But I want to continue just to zoom out a little bit here. I want to talk just a little bit and get your thoughts on what we've seen more generally during this first term of the Biden administration when it comes to Republican attorneys general stepping up to the batter's box and trying to stop, more generally speaking, a lot of the harm that is being done in Washington, D.C. So, you know, I lived in Texas for 4 years. I live in Florida now, and Attorney General Ken Paxton gets a lot of the headlines when it comes to this. But I think it's worth emphasizing that General Paxton is far from the only one. He's far from the only Republican attorney general who's been doing yeoman's work over the past few years. And, sir, I certainly count you in that camp. So why don't you just talk a little bit more generally about the importance of red state attorneys general trying to hold in line the current regime in Washington, D.C.?
Well, you know, Madison predicted in the Federalist Papers that Congress would defend itself against encroachment by an overzealous executive. We have found that Congress has transmogrified over the last number of years. And it's now more of a shouting club where people are interested in posturing and using it as a platform than they are actually legislating, which has left the field vacant. And presidents from George W. Bush onwards have been increasingly resorting to executive action in place of Congress's proper role as a legislator. So the end of the day, we fortunately have more than one kind of separation of powers. The separation of powers, of course, we well know horizontally between the judiciary, the executive, legislative, but there's also a separation of powers between the states and the federal government that the states created with enumerated powers. So who actually pushes that? And at the state level, it's definitely the state attorneys general. It's not a bug. It's actually a design feature for our system. And I've been proud to work alongside some brilliant minds who have taken a very aggressive stance toward the unconstitutional, unlawful abuse of power by the current executive.
And what are some of the cases that you've been working on in challenging Biden administration policies? I'm thinking here of anything from energy to student loans, any cases that really jump right to the forefront of your mind when it comes to what Ohio has been leading the charge on?
Well, sure. We've done cases regarding religious liberty. We have been right in the middle of the Ohio's an energy producing state, energy exporting state, and an automotive state. So we have been at the forefront of challenging everything from the EPA waiver for California to set their own emission standards, to some of the more esoteric whole of government approaches that the Biden administration has been employing to try to force the end to hydrocarbons as a source of energy.
I mean, the Biden administration's war on energy has been certainly at the forefront of, I think, many of our radars for years now. The ban on the export of liquefied natural gas, LNGs. I actually saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal that this past weekend they went into suburban Pittsburgh, which obviously is not Ohio, but it's not terribly far from the Ohio border, and it was a really interesting dive on how these former steel manufacturing towns, these former steel workers whose jobs have essentially been offshored over the past 20, 30 years, which, as a matter of policy, I have many objections to that. But holding that aside, the article was showing how many of them have found new employment in recent years in the booming energy industry there in eastern Ohio and western Pennsylvania, and how many of these voters are not exactly happy with the Biden administration's war on energy, which has really just been sprawling and, I think, debilitating for a whole host of Americans all across the country. General Yost, I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about what's actually going on inside the state of Ohio itself. And we recently saw how Governor DeWine vetoed this transgender law. This is back in January, if memory serves. And then the veto was overridden by the Ohio legislature. So Ohio has become one of the most recent states to proscribe what I sometimes colorfully refer to as chemical castration for minors, what I think the mainstream corporate media would prefer to label as so-called gender-affirming care, but I choose to not play such Orwellian rhetorical games. In any event, it, as we all knew, was immediately sued by liberal legal activists. Can you just give us the state of play of that particular litigation and just give us, from your perspective, what Ohio is trying to do with this law?
Well, the law itself is pretty straightforward. It does not impact any adult. So if you're 18 and have gender dysphoria, or you want to seek medical treatment to alter your body, it's a free country. You're allowed to do that within the regulation of the medical profession. What this law does is says that minors aren't allowed to make adult irreversible decisions. And when we're talking about surgery, when we're talking about chemical interventions, these kinds of things are at least much of the time not reversible medically. And we know by at least anecdotal evidence that some of the young people who have elected for those kinds of treatments as adults, when they are sterile, when they have developmental changes to their bodies in various ways, that they regret them because they simply weren't ready to make those choices. What the legislature did is said, we're going to treat kids like kids, and you're not allowed to buy alcohol and tobacco. You're not allowed to get a tattoo without parental consent. You can't enter a legally binding contract even with parental consent. You can't vote even with parental consent. And the reason is you don't have very good judgment yet. You're a kid. Right. You're still growing up. You're still getting experience in the world, still developing your judgment. And we've got this long tradition in many laws that are designed to protect young people while they are growing. This is one more, and I'm very confident that we're going to be able to defend this in court.
And it's such an important law. Politically speaking, incidentally, this is an issue from all the polling that I have seen that Republicans can solidly count as a winning issue. The independent voters, the swing state voters, moderate voters tend to be on the side of civilizational sanity on this one, namely that, as you said, minors should not be responsible for doing irreversible damage to their hormones and doing all sorts of things that in any other context we would not permit a minor to do. And I think it's so important, like a state that perhaps was once a purple state. I mean, Ohio was probably the definitional swing state, but an increasingly red state. I think it's so important for Ohio to lead the way on this. And I know that I was personally delighted to see the legislature there override the governor's veto. And I'm really happy that your office is now defending this law in court. General Yost, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the settlement, which, if I'm not mistaken, was just handed down this week. So Norfolk Southern has reached a $600 million settlement when it comes to the horrific derailment a little over a year ago in East Palestine, Ohio. I know that your office was involved there. You had filed, I believe it was a 58-count civil damages lawsuit against Norfolk Southern for its negligence. And what's your view? It's kind of just breaking news, honestly. What is your view of this settlement? Are you satisfied? Is this the end of this legal story?
Well, it's not. That is simply a settlement of the class action, which, as you know, is representing individual plaintiffs that were harmed. We still have the harms extant to the state, and we have a lot of unanswered questions. So my lawsuit on behalf of the state of Ohio has not yet been settled, and I don't intend to settle it, candidly, until we have answers. We're looking at the class action settlement. I don't know that we would try to intervene and object to it. I don't yet have an informed opinion about it because we didn't negotiate it, and we found out about it probably about 5 minutes before you did.
Fair enough. No, it was just such breaking news. I would have been remiss if I did not ask you about it. Well, Dave Yost, once again, is the Attorney General of Ohio, one of the nation's most important states. He's been in that position since January 2019. He's doing yeoman's work when it comes to a whole host of issues, from transgender to energy to Second Amendment gun rights and everything else. So, General Yost, we thank you for your great work on behalf of the Buckeye State and its voters. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was wonderful to talk to you, Josh, and thank you for shining a light on some of these issues that might be a little more complicated than the mainstream media wants to dive into, but we appreciate your podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.